dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
All right, all right, all right. Welcome to Maximum Film. This is episode 203. We are going to be talking about Space Jam, A New Legacy, and somehow, curiously, Iffy Wadaway is not here to discuss it with us. Thankfully, I have two stellar gentlemen who are up to the task, I am sure. And so I will bring them to you now. Alonzo Duralde, what is good?
Oh, I'll tell you, Drea. What's good, of course, is that Ted Lasso season 2 is dropping today, or starting today, rather, because, you know, they make you wait for them over at Apple TV. But what I really wanted to recommend is the show that is maybe its antithesis vibe-wise, in that the lead character is completely lacking in self-esteem and is a schemer and very as negative as Ted is positive. And that would be Physical, starring the great Rose Byrne in a 1980s set tale of a very unhappy woman who finds some level of fulfillment in aerobics, but not so much fulfillment that her life isn't a complete catastrophe, dragging down everyone around her in the vortex. It is sharp and funny, and also, like, her inner monologue is so ruthless and unsparing and self-defeating that it's just like you'll get your kegels in. And her husband, who's played by Rory Scovel, is such a early 80s, like, sexist, you know, grossness that if you ever wanted to explain to somebody what a microaggression is, just watch what this guy does and says. It's extraordinary. I really love this show. It's got a couple episodes to go. I know you like to wait for a show to be complete before you do your bin. So season 1, almost done. And when it is done, I think you'll really dig it. So if you're getting the Apple TV, like, free trial just to watch Ted Lasso, add this to your list of other things they've got on the service that you really want to see.
Okay. I covet Rose Byrne's hair in that. I'm not going to lie to you. It is the opposite of what my hair is, and I adore it. So, yeah. And that's what I'm looking for in my television. Hair.
Hair.
Okay, so like I said, Iffy somehow not here to discuss Space Jam. So there is only one being that can still bring an energy, a snark, and then, you know, just is lovingly already in our embrace. And that is our producer, Casey O'Brien. Da, da.
Hi, everybody.
Casey, you're here officially.
Oh,
this
my
whole
gosh.
Episode.
And what a film to join you to.
Oh, right? You were like, yes, let me talk about this. What's good with you, Casey?
Well, Drea, I visited the motherland this weekend. I was in Minnesota this weekend.
Yeah?
Yes, I was up. Yeah, I was at my parents' cabin up in Dent, Minnesota.
Oh, yeah, and, right on the lake.
Yep, right on the lake in Otter Tail County. And it was just glorious. It couldn't have been more beautiful. I was just, you know, bobbing in the lake, drinking a Grain Belt beer. It was just fantastic. So I'm still kind of, you know, awash in that glow from this past weekend.
Was there a pontoon?
It was wonderful. There was no pontoon, but there was a speedboat and there was water skiing. So we were out on the lake,
oh,
but
sure.
We were not
oh,
in a
yeah.
pontoon. We saw a pontoon, but I was not physically on one.
Exciting.
You had a green belt, but did you drink any pig's eye?
I didn't have any pig's eye,
no.
No.
Huh? Okay.
I had a Leinenkugel summer shandy.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, it was just phenomenal.
Drea, what's good?
Oh, thanks. My what's good, you guys know that every once in a while I'm just moved by a snack. And now is that time. There are these flat pretzel crisps made, and I love and adore them. They are in flavors like buffalo chicken. They're not the chicken flavor, but it's like that Frank's buffalo whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
But they have, like, an everything bagel flavored one. I know I say bagel wrong. That's fine. Again, I am from Minnesota. I can't help myself.
I thought it sounded just fine.
Thank you. Yeah, so I love them and they're addictive, but they're also still very light. It's a good little snacking. They're by something called the Snack Factory. Sad but true. I didn't name it, but I do eat them.
I was going to ask you the brand because there is a very famous South Dakota pretzel, Dots, which have kind of sprung up lately, which are equally addicting.
Got me hooked on the Dots. Yes. They're so good.
Yes.
And they're expensive if you don't live in South Dakota, apparently.
Yeah, well, you know, they've been popping up. I saw them at a 7-Eleven here recently. So they're making their way to Los Angeles, and those are addicting. They have like an MSG something on there. I don't know.
Okay, first off, MSG is not a bad thing, and there's been a million things that put out how all of the bad rap about it was entirely racist. It's not bad for you, it'll mess you up, whatever.
I'm pro MSG. I'm just saying the flavor is of that kind of, it unlocks the umami and the saltiness.
Yes,
exactly.
Listen, I'm not above a nice pretzel showdown, so I will keep my eye out for some Dots. I mean, that's truly, I really brought you guys here today to discuss my pretzel desires. But in addition to that, we are going to be discussing one, Space Jam, A New Legacy. We're going to be getting a question from our hotline. And as ever, we will have our staff picks. But first, it is time for our news segment, Itadic, which is short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer said question. Is this important? Do I care? So, let me start you off with one of our favorites, Mr. Nicolas Cage, who in a recent interview with Variety about his new film, Pig, he spoke about his disillusionment with the Hollywood studio system. Quote, "I do feel that I've gone into my own wilderness. I don't know if I'd want to go back. I don't know if I want to go back and make another Disney movie. When I was making Jerry Bruckheimer movies back to back, that was just a high pressure game. There were a lot of fun moments, and I will add one of those fun moments is, give me back my bunny.
Put the bunny in the box.
Exactly. At the same time, there was also, we wrote this line, it has to be said this way. On independent movies, you have more freedom to experiment and be fluid. There's less pressure, and there's more oxygen in the room. The last live-action feature he made with a major studio was 2011's Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance. Since that time, he has made over 30 live-action independent films, many of which were direct-to-video. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, Nicolas Cage, here's the thing. He is a brilliantly talented actor who has made shitty movies for studios and not for studios. Like, he's churned out some real doozies over the years. As great as they can be and have been, they churn out a lot of just junk. And so, yes, I saw Pig today. It's terrific, and I hope people check it out. But let's not get into this illusion of like, oh, yes, Nicolas Cage needs to go indie, because even indie, he can make some really terrible, terrible films.
Well, I was shocked when I wrote up this beautiful script for you guys. Sure. I was shocked at just kind of clicking around his IMDb. I was like, when they said that he's done over 30 live action movies since Ghost Rider, I was shocked at how many I have just flat out never even heard of. So many of them. So he's just churning these out.
Oh, you didn't see
so
Trespass
quickly.
With Nicole Kidman, directed by the late Joel Schumacher?
I missed that one.
Woo-hoo. Those are all actual big names, though. The one plus of this...
Yeah, but it also sucked.
Okay. Well, yeah, but like many people have a real interesting ratio of good to suck. Fair enough. The bonus on the indie side of it, like I have friends, Ben and Alex Brewer, who made a film starring Nick Cage called The Trust. And, you know, it's first-time filmmakers, the idea of getting to make something with a major Hollywood star, how that helps their career, how it helps the financing for that movie, like a lot of those things. Nick Cage being into working with untested directors just for the fun of it, a lot of stars, I mean, he's an A-level star, won't make themselves vulnerable in that way because of exactly what Alonzo's talking about, like the crapshoot of potential, you know.
Well, and you have to wonder, like, at what point does that, you know, having Oscar winner Nick Cage in your movie necessarily become a draw for any kind of financing if he's making 8 movies a year and 6 of them are like just sort of negligible Euro trash thrillers that no one's going to see, you know?
But those still sell. Like the market that, if you ever go to a, like, even Ken's Market, like, sure, you go to any, like, marketplace that's adjacent to a film festival, you're going to be like, what in the shit are all these movies? And how is Steven Seagal in half of them? Like, there are a whole breed of films that are made that do well internationally that are probably terrible. And it's the idea, again, of the business side of this. But I do think it's fun. And I also understand, like, Nick Cage seems someone who approaches his craft in a very artistic and full-bodied manner. Like, when Nick Cage is in a film, he's going to give you line readings nobody else is. Like, there's nobody else that's going to be bringing the weird intensity and energy that he is to anything that he does, right?
There's something kind of honorable, kind of in the same way that Adam Sandler just, like, churns out films. And it seems like Nicolas Cage and guys like Adam Sandler, it seems like they do just like to work. And so I do sort of appreciate that about Nicolas Cage, that he's just always working on something.
His work ethic is second to none. I will absolutely give
it is second to Eric Roberts, because I will bring it up every time I can.
Yeah.
Eric Roberts, spend any time, just go to IMDb. That man has regularly clocked more than 100 credits a year.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wild. I didn't
Eric
know.
He's
Roberts,
the voice in a talking cat, for God's sake.
Like, you cannot keep up with Eric Roberts. So don't try. Just enjoy what he's doing.
All right. Moving on. Ooh, this is exciting. This is my first time getting to read a news item.
Oh, what a rush,
Casey. Well, there's a new documentary out about the late great chef Anthony Bourdain. It's called Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain. And in a recent interview with GQ, the doc's director, Morgan Neville, who most recently directed Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers documentary, and the Orson Welles doc, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, he spoke about the use of artificial intelligence in the film Roadrunner to create Anthony Bourdain's voice. Quote, "We fed more than 10 hours of Tony's voice into an AI model. The bigger the quantity, the better the result. The filmmaker got permission from Bourdain's widow and his literary executor to use AI to recreate some of Bourdain's written words. And according to the director, he used this technique in order to, quote, make Tony's words come alive. Is this important? Do you care?"
Oh, it's important.
Oh, it's definitely, there's a few things of import here. One is that his widow actually came out and said, no, in fact, she did not give permission for that, which immediately makes it a little more suspish. But there's also, you know, because again, this AI, the words that he's saying in the documentary are Anthony Bourdain's own words. It's from his writing. And I think there was a way, if it had even had a title card at the beginning, like in lieu of a narrator, we have manufactured Anthony Bourdain's voice to read his own writing. To clarify that for the audience, I think it's that sort of like slippery, we're pulling things over, that has a sort of manipulative feel rather than we're just trying to give you a clean artistic element. But the other thing with this is, you know, in the few days after this, so at the end of the movie, David Cho, who's an artist, comments about how there are these like spray painted Anthony Bourdain things and that Tony
murals.
Would hate that. Murals, things. That's the technical term, things. There's these spray painted murals of Anthony Bourdain and Tony would hate it. And I want to spray your paint over them. And so they show him doing that. And then this week it came out that in fact, the spray painting that they show happened a year later and he's spray painting work that the producers commissioned. And so it's again, this totally manufactured thing that comes across. And it's hard because it is, you know, a lot of documentary, a lot of what you're doing is manifesting story through reality, and the murkiness on the edges of that is always tricky to navigate, I think.
It's like broadcast news all over.
Very broadcast news.
I don't want to jump too hard on this because, you know, I remember when The Thin Blue Line came out in 1988, 89, people were horrified that Errol Morris was recreating like crime scenes and sort of like, you know, was hiring actors to sort of like move around and stand places. Like basically just he was not doing this sort of pure documentary where all you had to work with were, you know, photographs and clippings and whatever footage might exist. And so obviously the documentary has evolved since then. You have people using animation, you know, to sort of portray certain things that that no footage would exist of, or for that matter, full-length animated documentaries, you know. So, I mean, we're always kind of changing how docs are told and what how contemporary tools can be used to do that. And I agree with Dre. I think if he had just said that up front, that everybody would have been fine with it, you know. And I think in another case, like, they would have just hired a sound alike, or had somebody reading it for him, whatever, you know. And nobody would have batted an eye. But the fact that they were kind of like, you know, keeping it a secret and then talking about it after the fact, and then the widow saying nobody asked me, you know, that all is all a little dodgy. And we're also now really steamrolling our way into the age of the deep fake, you know. And so. Yeah. People can really manipulate image and sound now to have people doing things that's completely not ever something they did. So, yes, they use the AI to read words that Bourdain himself had written. I think that there is an acceptability level there. But I think, you know, we need to be really careful about how this technology gets used moving forward, because the capacity to abuse it obviously is enormous.
Oh, truly. Like, you tell me that, simply all we did was feed a computer 10 hours of this man speaking so that now it can replicate it. I'm like, this is some sci-fi nonsense. Get me out of here. Nobody better put any of our episodes into something. I don't need to hear my shrill tone coming at me from some other direction.
Yeah, this digital necromancy, I think that's what they're calling it. It does kind of make me feel icky. It's like Peter, when they did Peter Cushing in Star Wars, you know, they like digitally remade him for one of the movies, and it does.
Rogue One, I think.
Was that Rogue One? Yeah. And, you know, I feel like sometimes movies get in trouble, and I mean, documentaries are kind of a different issue, but there's sort of a lack of, you know, in the theater, you can cast, you know, different races for different parts. There's a lot more leeway in terms of sort of literal interpretation. But sure. Movies, I feel like things now need to be so hyper accurate in order to trick the audience that it's kind of taken away some of that theatricality. And I don't know. It's sort of an uncreative step forward, I feel like, in terms of making movies that I don't particularly love.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, Fred Astaire dancing with a vacuum cleaner was bad enough.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm only a fan of it if it's marketing. You know, if they're yes, going to be selling something, then by all means,
yes,
bring
please.
Them on in.
Yes. It's a true American art form.
Exactly.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes the things people say need some correction in post. For instance, the Cannes Film Festival was this last week. The winner of the festival's highest award, the Palme d'Or, was Julia Ducournau's Titane. But during the announcement ceremony, jury president Spike Lee messed up on the order of awards and presented the Palme d'Or first, instead of last. Here's a clip of the cock-up.
Monsieur le Président, est-ce que vous pouvez nous dire quel sera le premier prix? Can you tell me which prize is the first prize?
Yes, I can.
Mais oui.
Cool.
The film that won the Palme d'Or is Titane.
Wait,
le film qui a reçu la Palme d'Or. Non.
Ah, on a évité le pire. No. Okay, Tahara va lui expliquer comment ça se passe. Moi-même, j'ai mis un peu de temps à comprendre.
Oh my God, I turned full Wicked Witch of the West.
I think I see what they did there, but is this important? Do you care?
I don't know if this is that important. I think it's a really sweet moment. I mean, it's not like the La La Land goof, you know? Yes. It was still the right person, and I feel like, you know, Spike Lee doesn't speak French. Clearly, there was a little bit of a mix up there, and it ended up being kind of a sweet moment. If you see the video clip, everyone's laughing. One of the actors comes up and gives him a hug. I think it was Tahar Rahim, kind of gives him a hug, and like the Titan people were like, "Oh, that's fine, Spike, not a big deal." So I felt like it was kind of a heartwarming goof in a time where, you know, that you know, during COVID, those sort of things didn't happen as much. So I thought that was kind of nice.
I'm sure
for
them it was nice. But then you're also looking at, like, the Palme d'Or, of course, is the big prize of the night. It's your best picture, as it were. And so there's
everybody else is a loser.
Yeah, there's the anticlimactic nature of all of the smaller awards that come after of like, okay, well, there's still also us. Wait, is everyone leaving? And then there's the like
the people cinematography,
who
you guys
are like, oh, we lost, and now we get to sit through this whole thing. So yeah, and again, yes, this is not important in the sense that this is, I don't think, like, hugely negative or painful or anything like that that's going to be lasting.
I had read about this, but hearing the woman say, what is the first prize? I'm like, oh, I see where the problem has. Because the first prize also means the top prize.
Yeah, number, the blue ribbon.
Yeah, a little bit of translation thing there. This seems to be happening a lot lately. Like, it never used to happen. In the last 5 years or so, we've had La La Land. We had Steve Harvey getting wrong at some pageant. Like, yes. It seems like nobody knows how to read a teleprompter anymore or do a run of show. And I just wonder, like, how do we fix that?
That's so interesting. Yeah, what's going on with these celebrities? They need to be better at reading
their cue
cards.
In addition to our lifespan shortening, everyone's just dumber. Yeah, that's my scientific thing. I'll say, of course, obviously for us, justice for Aileen, because
yes,
you know,
hashtag justice for
Aileen. If Maximum Film stands for anything, it's that the number one film this year, sight unseen by me to this day,
yes,
is going to be Aileen, the unauthorized Celine Dion biopic.
Sort of, I guess.
Biopic.
If listeners, if you have not read Kyle Buchanan's rundown of his first viewing of Aileen that he wrote for the New York Times, all the Cannes Film Festival, go find it and read it. It is one of the funniest things I've ever read. And Aileen is even nuttier than we realized from the trailer, because the director plays Aileen from like the age of 5 until like
the
30, and she's 57.
Year old director.
Yes. I was getting there.
Oh, sorry. I screwed up that you had it all primed and ready. I just got so excited.
No, I know.
I love it so much, Alonzo. Yeah.
See, that's like the type of theater I'm talking about, that I want returned to cinema.
Oh, yeah, no digital effects used to make that happen. Yes.
No. I will talk over you as a human or an AI. That's what I bring to the table. Okay, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking. We are... about Space Jam, A New Legacy.
Since the dawn of time, screenwriters have taken months to craft their stories. But now, three Hollywood professionals shall attempt the impossible. Break a story in 1 hour.
That's right. Here on Story Break, I, Freddie Wong,
Matt Arnold,
and Will Campos,
the creators behind award-winning shows like Video Game High School,
have 1 hour to turn a humble idea into an awesome movie.
Now, an awesome movie starts with an awesome title.
I chose The Billionaire's Marriage Valley.
Mine was Christmas Pregnant Paradise.
Okay, next we need a protagonist.
So I've heard Wario best described as Libertarian Mario.
And of course, every great movie needs a stellar pitch.
In order to get to heaven, sometimes you gotta raise a little hell.
That's the tagline!
Check out Story Break every week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Storyblox is dedicated to being the world's best royalty-free stock media subscription service, with an ever-growing library that has more than 1 million high-quality stock assets, including 4K HD footage, After Effects and Premiere Pro templates, music, images, sound effects, and more. They have affordable subscription plans and tools, and with Storyblox's unlimited all-access plan, you can get unlimited downloads of everything in their library. And even if your subscription ends, everything you've downloaded is yours to keep. Restock is an ongoing initiative to capture footage of those underrepresented in stock to increase diversity in stock footage.
Yeah, Storyblox is an incredibly useful tool for filmmakers or anybody who's trying to put together any sort of video or project of any kind. I've used music on Storyblox several times for this very show. In our promo for this show, I needed sort of a sweeping, suspenseful, cinematic song to go under this goofy promo we put together, and I found one on Storyblox that worked perfectly, and I downloaded it and used it immediately. I also was doing another project recently where I needed some stock video footage of like a horror movie. And I was like, I can't shoot a horror movie right now. I don't have time. I'm making this podcast. But on Storyblocks, I was like, murder, stabbing. And they have these stock video things that they created with like a bloody hand going on the glass and streaking down. It was amazing. And I was able to use that for this project. So Storyblocks has all sorts of stuff for any level of filmmaker or anyone who's putting together a great project.
All right. So if you have something professional or something creepy like Casey to type in, hey. Storyblocks can set you up. Explore their library and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/maxfilm. That's storyblocks.com/MAXFILM. Let's get back to the show. Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Drea Clark. In the virtual studio with me are...
Alonzo Duralde.
Casey O'Brien.
All right. So this is now one of my favorite things that I get to do because we are going to be talking about Space Jam, A New Legacy. And to kick it off, I would like to ask producer Casey if he would provide us with a brief, all caps, Casey, sir, a brief synopsis.
Yes, I will take that direction. So, Space Jam, A New Legacy, stars LeBron James, the famous basketball player, as himself, and recast his entire family with different names, which I thought was very interesting, much like the original Space Jam. And his son, who I'm blanking on his name right now, but his son, Dom, he doesn't really want to play basketball. He wants to, you know, make video games. That's what his passion is. And he's very good at it, but LeBron James just wants him to play basketball. And so at a meeting at Warner Brothers Studio, an AI called...
Algorithm.
Algorithm, played by Don Cheadle. They pitch an idea to LeBron James where they could digitally put him all in all movies. Very current with this episode,
ooh,
actually.
Very.
And LeBron James is like, I don't like that. That upsets Algorithm, Don Cheadle. And so he sucks LeBron James and Dom into the video game or into the server of the Warner Brothers studio. So there's all the IP of everything at Warner Brothers. And he challenges LeBron James to a basketball game for some reason. And if LeBron James wins, the Toons, they get to leave the computer video game. And if he loses, LeBron James is stuck inside the server and the Looney Tunes get erased. Oh, also he gets paired up with the Looney Tunes for really, I'm not exactly sure the reason now after viewing it. Yeah, that's it. Space Jam, A New Legacy.
Alonzo and I will discuss with you later how brief we thought that
was. Okay, yeah. Sorry, it's harder.
Yeah, you got us there. Okay, so we absurdly discussed the original Space Jam in the last couple of months.
2 months, yeah.
Yep, we did that as part of the Ipichikude collection. Fun Drive.
Yes.
Exactly. And somehow Mr. Wadaway is... not here to discuss the second one because he can't handle the heat.
Yeah, that's although, oh, I got a text from Iffy about his review of the movie, and he said LeBron deserved better.
Oh.
That's his thoughts on it, so.
I was going to say that's like the closest thing to a burn from Iffy, but I've also heard him shriek at least one person in this call right now.
Yes.
So,
in the last episode.
A question that I have. This movie comes 29 years after the film that we watched, right? 25. I'm sorry. Did you just get math snitty?
I'm sorry. It was just a shocking number when I heard it. I'm sorry, Drea. That was...
how dare he? I'm not here for my math skills, sir. Anyway, would you consider this film a sequel to the first Space Jam?
I mean, in that the Looney Tunes show up again and they are forced to play another unfunny game of basketball, yes. But it's... the first movie is at least trying to play off of Michael Jordan's pivot from basketball to baseball and whether or not that was remotely a good idea. And this movie sort of presents LeBron James as kind of a dick dad.
Yes.
You know, the idea is that, like, well, I became this successful because I got ridden hard by my coach. And so now I'm going to pass those same toxic lessons along to my own children.
You mean His coach, Avon Barksdale, yes, from The Wire. Mm-hmm. I was like, Avon? Yeah.
This movie, I just annoyed me in so many ways.
It does sort of feel like we got pranked by Iffy a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's not even at this recording.
I know. I definitely, we're stuck holding the bag, and it is a bag of turds.
You guys, fun fact, I enjoyed this movie a lot more than
really?
I thought I would.
All right, well, tell it.
And by that, I mean, I thought I would enjoy it zero, and instead I was like, okay. Like, if I had children, then I could see this be, I have definitely watched worse family movies. And it also helped me. So, you know, as Casey said, the setup of this is the idea of them going once again, like the Silicon Valley guarded by Henry Phillips, the like wall of servers or the entire room of servers, they get like uploaded into this and it's like all of the Warner Brothers properties or something. And I think it's from my talk with civilians, because I know people outside of the entertainment industry, not to brag, but it's always interesting to me how most viewers look at IP in such a different way than those of us who are talking about it all the time as like IP or content. And like the friends that have children that I talked to about this movie were like, oh, they freaking loved every time that they crossed over into like, you know, we see Mad Max, we see Casablanca, we see, and there's things like that that I was like, oh, those seem like a real like Warner Brothers stretch, which they are, but a lot of people love a crossover.
Okay, that's where I wanted to start. I also love a crossover, and I was thinking about this, like over the course of my life, I have loved the notion of characters that I know in a place that I wouldn't expect them. Like when I was a little kid, DC and Marvel, after decades of bitter rivalry, put out Superman versus Spider-Man, which blew my little like 11-year-old mind when that came out, because I just, the kind of thing you just never thought would happen. You never thought you were going to see those characters interact, you know, Lex Luthor and Doc Ock and Mary Jane and Lois Lane and all that stuff. You know, like I was down for it. I was very excited about it. You know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? The classic example, you know, like let's put Donald Duck and Daffy Duck on screen together and let's come up with something funny for them to do. And this movie, they leave out the funny part. They don't come up with anything that's remotely clever. So what you're talking about, the Casablanca Mad Max part, that's my favorite part of the movie. It lasts approximately 3 minutes. And after Bugs has plucked the various tunes out of Mad Max and Casablanca and various other Warner Brothers properties, we are left with this cacophonous, ugly basketball game where the people in the stands include like Jabberjaw and, you know, Eartha Kitt Catwoman standing next to Michelle Pfeiffer Catwoman and, you know, the Animaniacs and a nun from Ken Russell's The Devils. All of which is like, okay, fine. But then all they're doing is watching a basketball game.
Oh, see, I think that stuff worked for me as well, because the basketball game was enjoyable enough for me to follow. And like, oh, okay. So the point of it, right, is that like Alonzo said, LeBron, and I actually credit LeBron for letting his character be enough of a inconsiderate dad that he has an actual arc, because there's that whole thing of, they also do such LeBron ass kissing of the best, you know,
the
like
greatest
you see this LeBron
athlete of all time.
Right,
yes.
Well, and it allows Don Cheadle to do Hook on the kid, you know.
Yes. I wrote that down too. I wrote Hook. Yeah. This is Hook.
This movie is Hook, and it's also Ready Player One. It's like, oh, great. Yes. Spielberg's two worst films. Hooray. Because again, I like the idea of Baby Jane Hudson and the Droogs from A Clockwork Orange
interacting. So
but if all they're going to do is stand on the sidelines of a basketball game, that's fucking boring.
Oh, see, I loved just having them in the crowd, scanning the crowds, being regularly like, is that Dorothy? Like,
here's my thing about the crowd. It was that a lot of them were like really bad costumes, I felt like. Or they were like, looked like they were at a bad Halloween party.
Or like a
just kind
theme
of hanging
park greeter, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's like, I like the idea of, yes, give me a flying monkey next to Daphne from the Scooby-Doo. But they can't just stand next to each other. It's like you're stuck at the ending of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, where like Carol Channing is next to Dr. John, and who cares?
That feels like it could have been.
I don't want to hear these people talk. That could have. There's already 15 talking characters.
I feel like they could have cut to the audience once in a while and had a like funny interaction there. I think that's possible. I have to speak for the person who liked the original Space Jam when I saw it. When I saw Space Jam, that's why I had to be on the show today. I was 8 years old. And I remember thinking when I left the theater, I remember I went with my grandparents and said, that was the worst movie I've ever. They said, that was the worst movie I've ever seen. And I was confused why they said that because I remember thinking, I don't understand why this wouldn't win an Academy Award for Best Picture. And that's sort of the mindset I was in. And so I was sort of comparing this movie to that one, like as if that was good and this had to like live up to that. But
did you rewatch it recently the way we were forced
to? I watched it very recently. Okay. It's hard though for me to really extricate myself from that 8 year old.
Yeah, the classic was it greater were you eight?
Yeah, exactly. Like I still love Hook and it's hard for me to say that that was a bad movie, but I just felt like this was not a sequel. This is just a remake, I felt like, because there's no continuation of events. And
well, except for one pretty good Michael Jordan joke.
That was funny. Yeah. That was funny. But other than that, I found myself too confused with plot goings on that it kind of took me out of it. But maybe this, I'm also sensitive to the fact that maybe this is just not for me. Maybe this is for 8 year olds, you know?
I think, yeah, I definitely, again, everything I'm saying is it's all relative. It's more like my expectations were like, oh my God, I can't believe you guys are making me watch this. So I found that there were either jokes in it or usage of the creatures, or they were doing different animation styles. There were things in it that I was enjoying. And I also liked the sort of lessons they were doing there. Like this main thing is LeBron has three kids in this, as in real life, but they have different names for some reason. The main kid is not interested in basketball. He's interested in coding and in playing a video game and or making a video game. And LeBron isn't like a fully terrible, like neglectful. He's just like disinterested and wants his kids to work hard in the exact same way he did.
I was surprised at how mean he was.
He does come off as kind of a pill from time to time. I do think that actually the relationship between him and the son is like one of the best things the film has going for it, just because, you know, the kid, you know, Cedric Joe, who plays Dom, is really good. And LeBron isn't like the greatest actor. I mean, like he's really funny in Trainwreck. I really liked him a lot in that one. This one, he feels a little more stiff. Like you can tell, like Don Cheadle is overplaying opposite LeBron because LeBron is underplaying so much. But LeBron and Cedric Joe have an interesting screen chemistry, and I bought them as father and son, and you know I thought that stuff was actually was pretty good. But here's the thing that I personally am not into is turning the Looney Tunes into three-dimensional characters. Like if I can see Bugs Bunny's fur and like Daffy Duck's feathers, like that just, we haven't gotten to a place yet where I don't find that off-putting.
I guess my big question is, you know, because when Space Jam came out in 1996, I feel like Looney Tunes was actually kind of back in the conversation. It was like on Nickelodeon. I watched it all the time. I think there were like new episodes coming out of Looney Tunes. Also, there was like
the Tiny Toons.
Tiny Toons, and like Tweety Bird was on like a denim jacket or something. like there was commercials with the Looney Tunes around. And I just don't get the sense, like when Bugs came on the screen in this one, I was like, oh, I guess I haven't seen him in a while. And I just don't know if kids know, like if they're around
I think now. HBO Max, I think, did a new Looney Tunes series.
Oh, okay.
In the last
I just wasn't sure about
that. I've seen some bits of it. It actually seemed pretty funny. But I mean, like, I grew up watching them very regularly on Saturday morning, and then like once I started getting my hands on like having a VCR, like Warner Brothers would put out these hour-long compilations of like, you know, Chuck Jones and, you know, Friz Freleng and Tex Avery and like these different sort of major directors from there. So I'm kind of steeped in this, so I might be a little more annoyed when I feel like they're not being used to their potential. And I don't feel like they're written all that funny in this movie. Like there's one bit involving Wile E. Coyote and an Acme duplicating machine and a Zamboni that I thought was hilarious, but beyond that I didn't feel like, oh, these guys really get the voice of these characters and what they're
about. I agree. I think it's less that they are trying to make them funny, because I fully agree with you. I don't think they come across as like, ooh, what a laugh riot. But I did like that the gist of what they're doing is being loony. And it's this idea of like, of one of the lessons LeBron has to learn is to value imagination and to value creativity. And that, you know, even the team of Looney Tunes he's leading with the, and he's the best basketball player alive. Like, they can't win just playing the fundamentals. You have to get crazy and respect that. And yeah. I kind of loved that as a message. And they did do anarchy pretty well. There was like Granny was a whole lot, but also as someone who has like, I have slight basketball knowledge. So like Damian Lillard being in there, like Dame Time is a whole thing. Like that is a very, not obviously not how they use it, but like they refer to that because he is like this clutch shooter and is all like, so yes. The fact that they built an entire character around this like known basketball players thing, and then had the Granny like age him up, like those are like fun, again, crossover details that I
like. There was a lack of like jokes, I felt like. Like the first one, they at least were like, I feel like there was like, they were making jokes. And this one, I felt like there was sort of a lack of that. And it's funny because, you know, I'm a big sports fan. So I've known about everybody's known about this movie coming out for a long time. But there was sort of a narrative of that LeBron James was having a really hard time recruiting basketball players to be in this movie because it's like, no one wants to be second fiddle to like LeBron James, you know? So it was just sort of, I was sort of interested in like, oh, who's actually going to pop up in this?
Yeah. Alonzo Casey really wants us to know he likes sports.
Yes, I like sports. Very impressed.
Very, very key.
This movie podcast thing is just sort of a side hustle fandom.
He's all sports all the time. In my defense, I do want to say I thought the original came out in 92, and thus my terrible math was actually based on an actual different number than the year of its release. That's what I was going to say. Sorry. The idea of the main thing that makes it surprising that this wasn't trying to be funnier is this is the director of Girls Trip. A movie that made me almost pee through a dress. So, like, I don't know if it's shockingly, it's possible Tiffany Haddish is funnier than LeBron James. not to blow your minds. But.
I mean, I have to admit, like, the first movie was made by, like, this guy who came from commercials. This time you've got Malcolm Lee, you've got Ryan Coogler producing. I'm thinking, okay, well, that's something. And yeah, you know, I will say a shout out to Max Fun mate Morgan Rhodes from Heat Rocks, who was one of the music supervisors on the film. I do think the songs are very well selected, and they move the action along well. And I couldn't name a single one of them, but
that's how you know it's an actual sports movie, because they definitely play Pump Up the Jams.
I know that. Hey, I saw
exactly. That's what I mean. We get that one.
I saw Technotronic live opening for Madonna on the Blonde Ambition tour. So yeah,
that's great.
Yes, you did.
But I will leave it at this. I do not buy the argument of like, it's for kids. They'll watch anything. It's like, yeah, well, kids will also eat anything that's under the sink, and it will poison them if you don't keep an eye on what they're putting into their mouth. You know, we've just come off of Luca and The Mitchells versus the Machines and like really great films that are aimed at a family audience. And so I don't buy that as an excuse. I'm not saying you know, if you like this film and you think it's good for kids, fine. But if it's like, it doesn't matter, it's for kids. No.
Oh yeah, I would never do that. Mine is more, I think kids would genuinely enjoy this. No. And they probably do, because I think the audience score of this movie is like A- or something.
Yeah, I was kind of gobsmacked about that. But you know, as the great H.L. Mencken once noted, nobody ever went broke underestimating the taste of the American public.
Okay, we're not going to be able to sum up this movie any better than that.
No.
So I think it's time for final reviews. What are you guys giving Space Jam: A New Legacy?
Well, surprise everybody, I'm a skip.
Yes,
I know. I thought this was agony, and it's 2 hours of agony, by the way. It's not, this is a full, you know, 120 minutes to tell this much story. I think just a misbegotten, a bad idea, and generally unpleasing.
I'm going to give this, you know, if he's not here, and I have to speak for Iffy, and I'm going to say stream it. I kind of enjoyed it. I mean, the beginning part was fun, and when the basketball game got going, I was kind of enjoying that, too. It is way too long. This movie should be 88 minutes. I can't believe it's 2 hours long. That's insane. And I think if I were a producer and I watched this movie, I would say there needs to be a reshoot of a new character in it, and he's the guy who oversees the servers at Warner Brothers, because at one point they upload like 20 million people or something. All of LeBron James's Twitter followers get uploaded onto the server, and no one, that seems to go unnoticed at a major studio. And I think they could have had Kevin Hart just shoot some scenes alone where he's freaking out about the server.
Silicon Valley took place, it is an HBO show. They can get Henry Phillips from Silicon Valley. Well, no, in my head, it's going to be Silicone. But they can get him. He's already guarding the servers for Pied Piper.
Yeah, that's it, something like that, that like someone's freaking out, because I was like, there's crazy stuff going on in there, and no one seems to be noticing in the outside world. So that's my punch-up idea.
There you go.
I'll say stream it. If you have it on in the background when you're like making dinner or something, it's fine.
Yeah, I'm a stream it if you have kids. I genuinely think kids would have a really fun time watching this, and I enjoyed how they used the different spaces and watching. I was like, I love, if I'm at a sporting event, most of the time I'm staring at the crowd anyway, so I really liked just sort of ogling through the crowd to figure out who was there. Although I 100% agree with Casey, some of these were the most half-assed, like Halloween
Party
Superstore. Yeah, like there's a dude who's playing the Smokin' from The Mask, like the full suit, and I was like, yes. Oh, you look so janky, I love it.
Yeah, the baby Jane
Hudson. I
bet you're
at Hollywood Boulevard busking right now.
The baby Jane Hudson costume came in a bag that said former child star or something.
Yeah. Oh my God, yes. I loved it. It did make me so happy though. All right, we'll be right back after we hear a quick message.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy.
It doesn't matter who you are or what you have, life can be stressful. We get that. I get that. And I think that a lot of people look at their mental health as something that only needs to be paid attention to when things get bad. But I think there is a lot to say for upkeep. And I also think there's a lot of gentleness you can be giving yourself in terms of counting and valuing the things you're going through, even if they don't seem like big deals, even if you can compare them to other people and think you have it better, it is still something you are working through, and having a professional to help you work through it can make a big difference.
Absolutely. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. And it's more affordable than in-person therapy. See if it's for you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Maximum Film listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/maxfilm. Have your first session in under 48 hours at betterhelp.com/maxfilm. That's MAXFILM.
Hey, I'm Jordan Morris, creator of the Max Fun scripted sci-fi comedy podcast, Bubble. We just released a special episode of Bubble to celebrate the launch of our new graphic novel. At SF Sketchfest in 2019, we recorded a live show with Allison Becker, Eliza Skinner, Mike Mitchell, Cristela Alonzo, and special guests Jean Grey, Jonathan Colton, Jesse Thorne, Nick Weiger, and a bunch of other cool folks.
We suspect he'll show signs of mutation when in a state of excitement. Now, Annie matched with him on Tinder, so she's going to act as the honeypot.
I do enjoy being called a honeypot.
Hey, you know what's better than honey? Gravy.
Oh yeah, can I be the gravy sack?
Out now on MaximumFun.org and wherever you get podcasts. And pick up the graphic novel at your local bookstore today.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I am your host, Drea Clark, and in the studio with me are...
Casey O'Brien.
Alonzo Duraldi.
All right, today we have a call on the hotline that we've been holding on to from back when we had our interim name. It is from Ray. Casey, play that call.
Hey, y'all. This is Ray. I use she or they pronouns. I just wanted to say I'm stoked to see y'all reevaluating the name of your podcast and the impact you want to leave on the world. It's good stuff. It did get me thinking. What are some of your favorite movies that, because of real life happenings, you can never watch again? You love them. You're probably not going to pick it up. Thanks. Bye. Hey, it's Ray again. You don't have to play this part on the show. I just realized retroactively that perhaps it sounded from my last voicemail like I wasn't going to keep listening to your untitled project. I absolutely am. I was just thinking about movies. This is why you shouldn't leave podcasters' voicemails in the wee hours of the morning. But as Drea can probably attest, us Midwesterners are very concerned about politeness. So I thought I would let you know that I still love you. Bye.
Oh my gosh, Ray for president. Oh, that was so great.
We love it.
That was so Midwestern. It also didn't occur to me that that's what they meant. But
me neither.
I always appreciate the clarity.
Take the note, folks. Do not leave these calls in the middle of the night, or maybe
how dare
second,
you? Do not.
You'll have second thoughts later.
I want so many middle
unfiltered
of the night calls. Please, please. That's all I want. I think that's a really interesting question because, you know, we are movie lovers, and we are also people alive in the world and having things happen to us that can, for good or bad, affect things. I know I have like entire categories of films now that because of real life are tricky for me.
I think for me, like, while the entire filmography of Woody Allen now clearly has, you know, a bit suspect, none more so than perhaps a film that for many years in my youth I considered to be one of the greatest films ever made, and that would be 1979's Manhattan, which even if you think that Woody Allen is 100% innocent, that movie still just does not play now, I don't think, 50 or so years later, or 40 years later. It's, the crux of the film is about this middle-aged guy's relationship with a 17-year-old high school student, and she's presented as the sort of beacon of wisdom and purity in the film, and it's just all really creepy and very groomy, and when I was 17, I thought, oh, well, yes, sure, of course, this is what the world, this is how the world works, and now that I'm older than the Woody Allen character, I'm like, no, it doesn't, no, it does not, it never has, stop it.
Yeah, I feel like there are so many... I mean, there's just so many disgusting filmmakers that it's like I don't really actively seek out. Like, once we know who they are,
sure.
I don't seek those films out anymore. In terms of like real life events happening to me, I remember I was watching Scenes from a Marriage by Ingmar Bergman, which is a film / series, I guess.
Miniseries.
Yeah. And I was... going through, it was in a bad relationship at the time, and I remember just being so affected by that movie and feeling like, oh my God, I have to break up with this woman. This is so horrible. I'm in a horrible place. I couldn't even finish it, and I don't think I ever will, because it'll transport me right back to that sort of anxiety, just misery of that time. So that's the first one that popped in my head when I heard this question.
Interesting.
That's interesting, because the time and place you see something can be as meaningful as the subject matter. I know for me, not in the time and space thing, but something I've revisited, like, and it sort of has to do with the person behind it, but basically like the Dirty Harry series. Those were movies I remember watching with my dad. Like, they were on like TV and this very like, ooh, we're bonding, we watch movies, and I really enjoyed them. Like, I loved that he had this sort of badassery to him that, you know, like, fuck it, I don't care, whatever. And other than, and my thoughts on Clint Eastwood could be a whole other branch of this,
sure,
but on top of that, if I look at that now and how it completely celebrates police officers going like against the law to get the job done. And right. mm-hmm. that it's literally, you know, the sort of the bad guy in it is claiming police brutality. Do you know what I mean? Like there's yeah. all of these things that I look up and I'm like, oh, this movie is part of the fabric that led to where we are now. And like the things that we hold up and admire in terms of like the renegade spirit or, you yeah. know, like the cops going rogue to like get the bad guy. And like, yeah, I feel as someone who lives in the current day, I would watch it just with my jaw like 15 inches below my knee, like just like what?
Yeah, you know, I mean, most of mine aren't so much about like sort of my kind of personal stuff, just in terms of just the way the world has changed, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, and yes, yeah, some awful things. I mean, like, I can't watch Death Proof anymore without thinking about what he did to Uma Thurman. Yeah. But like, you know, when I think about how we just sort of accepted Revenge of the Nerds for so long without really talking about how like super rapey that movie is.
Yeah.
It's like, oh,
there's so
yeah.
many movies of that era that are
the,
like,
yeah, the whole 80s pretty much
all is of the 80s, yeah. anything, any movie where the VHS copy involves dudes peeping through a window, anything like that, like there's such rape.
There could be a whole Tumblr account, you know, given to that type of cover.
It's
yeah.
so gross. And it's that they're gross and that they're all intended to be just jovial, lighthearted fun.
Innocent mm-hmm. good times.
Guys, boys being boys, you know?
Yeah.
Ugh. Okay, cool. Well, I'm going to stew on this for a while. Yeah. But
I do thank you, Ray.
Yes, thank you, Ray. I think that was a really good question. And I love that it was motivated just sort of musing over our own name change.
Yeah.
And I also love that you're still listening. So double yes. thanks to Ray.
Thanks for both calls.
Yes, we appreciate everyone who's called in. Again, I would like to encourage you to do so late at night. We do like the messages under 30 seconds so we can play them on air, so feel free to leave a couple and then just a rambling one that annoys Casey and then he can send to me for my delight, and then one we can leave on air, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
If you would like to leave us a question on the hotline, the number is 979-803-1664, or if you'd like to email a question, your length of ramble is your length of ramble, email us at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Okay, fellas, we're all the way to staff picks. It can be any movie at all, any movie in the whole universe. Alonzo, why don't you start?
Well, you know, having watched Space Jam, A New Legacy, and the great documentary Los Angeles Plays Itself, which will be the subject of an upcoming episode in close succession, it just reminded me again that Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a great movie, and that we keep trying to rekindle that magic, and it just hasn't quite worked with the success that it did there. And it's on Disney Plus, so you know it's there waiting for you. But that movie, I think it you know, the further away from it we get, the more and more I really appreciate the staggering achievement both of mixing, you know, human beings and animated backdrops and characters, but also of when you are let loose upon this sort of this massive IP, doing something with it. You know, the idea of Michael Jordan playing basketball with the Looney Tunes, or LeBron James playing basketball with the Looney Tunes while Baby Jane Hudson cheers from the sidelines. You got to have, that's not enough. You have to actually write situations and gags and, you know, play off of what we know or what maybe what we don't know about these characters and do something clever and fun. And Roger Rabbit does that consistently. And we've never reached that peak again. And I hope there's never a sequel because I'm sure they'll get it wrong. So, yes, ooh, Who Framed Roger Rabbit on Disney Plus.
Good call. Casey, what about you?
Well, you know, for a period there, for a couple weeks, people were returning to the office and got me thinking about office culture. And I love movies set in offices, particularly in the 90s. So I have kind of a double feature I want to recommend. It's two movies from 1997, both about the offices, both about directed by women. One is Clock Watchers by Jill Sprecher. It's now, it just got dropped on the Criterion Channel. You can also watch it on Prime, I believe. It's just a really funny, lighthearted movie with Parker Posey, Toni Collette, Lisa Kudrow, Bob Balaban, just about these temps working at, you know, some kind of nameless giant company and them banding together. And I just think it's a really delightful film.
Oh, there's
film.
Some darkness to that movie, too. It's not,
I guess,
it's
yeah,
not
there,
just
there
a
is,
romp.
Yes.
It's, there's some real intensity.
But I really like that movie a lot. And then also another movie, Office Killer,
yes,
by the artist Cindy Sherman. That one you can rent on Prime.
Oh, wow.
But that's I think it was unavailable for a
long
time.
Yeah, it was.
But recently,
I've been looking for it.
Yeah, recently you can rent it on Prime. Another dark kind of comedy set in an office. It stars Molly Ringwald, Carol Kane, Gene Triplehorn.
Barbara Sacova.
Yes, yes. And it's about kind of offices changing from, you know, manual typewriters to computers in the late 90s. And I don't know. It's just kind of a fun movie. So,
it's like an update of Desk Set.
Exactly. It's exactly like that.
That joke was for Alonzo. So I'm glad it landed.
I love both those films. They have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah, you don't often conflate Cindy Sherman with, you know, Hepburn and
Tracy.
Tracy, yeah.
But I love both those movies, and you should check them out. Make a good double feature.
For sure.
That's nice. That makes me super happy. Also, what makes me super happy is my staff pick. It is a film. It is the last film by Lynn Shelton, who is still desperately missed. And I really hope people watch this if they haven't seen it yet. It's called Sword of Trust. It's currently, recently now on Netflix. And Lynn was a spectacular humanist with her work and so funny. And this stars Marc Maron as a pawn shop owner. And then Michaela Watkins and Jillian Bell play a couple who are trying to sell to him and then use him as a broker to sell a sword from the Confederacy. And it is full of hijinks and warmth. And yes, please see it. Let Lynn's work live on. Alonzo and Casey, thank you for another special episode. Casey?
Yes.
You did a really good job.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm very
so
proud
kind.
Of you.
Oh, you guys.
You really did. You
Thank
brought
you.
Your A game. I could tell you were like just toeing the line. You're right up there.
As
just
the,
ready
as,
to play.
As the sports would say, you gave 110%.
Yes.
Thank you. I left it all on the court.
Say, you left it all on the court. All right.
Thank you so much.
Good job, guys. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/group/maximumfilm or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Ooh. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.